Good morning. The clerk will call a case, please.
Case number 29227, Steve Valasatos, attorney for the petitioner, Steve Valasatos, attorney for respondent, Teresa Garofalo.
Counsel, proceed.
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Steven Tsushima on behalf of the State of Hawaii. I've asked the court clerk to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. First off, I'd like to thank the court for accepting the state's application for writ of cert. In this case, the state presents to this court one question. Did the ICA gravely err in holding the family court was wrong by admitting into evidence as excited utterances offer Kubo's testimony regarding the RISA's utterances? We maintain the ICA gravely erred in three ways. First, in concluding that this case was not distinguishable from Machado, a case where the victim's statement was a detailed, logical, coherent, and lengthy narrative of the events of the entire evening. Second, in its reliance upon, as the ICA stated, quote, Officer Kubo's testimony that he needed to calm Larissa down when he asked her what happened, end quote, and concluding that this, quote, suggests that Larissa's statements were not spontaneous, end quote. And third, in handling Larissa's utterances as one statement, where she uttered, my boyfriend beat me up, immediately upon Officer Kubo's arrival, and later uttered, after being sat down by Officer Kubo further into the room, that, quote, she got into an argument with her boyfriend, and while inside the room, he punched her once in the face with enough force for her to fall onto the ground. While on the ground, he stomped on her right thigh. Now allow me to provide a short summary of the facts of the case. At trial, Larissa essentially testified that she did not remember anything that happened on the evening in question. She only remembered waking up the next morning with a hangover and that only her legs were sore, explaining that she rollerbladed so her muscles were always sore. Officer Kubo testified that on March 26, 2008, while on routine patrol in the Waikiki area, he responded to a dispatch call on an argument-type case to the Hawaiian Monarch located at 444 New Street. When he arrived on the scene minutes later at approximately 1:05, 1:07 a.m., he met with hotel security officers who escorted him to the room 2313. Once Officer Kubo arrived at the room, he met with Larissa, defendant, and another hotel security officer. Upon arrival into the hotel room, Officer Kubo immediately noticed that Larissa was really shaken, crying, and appeared to be in a lot of pain while he observed her limping. Officer Kubo asked Larissa what happened, and she uttered, my boyfriend beat me up. Officer Kubo then walked Larissa further into the room, seating her at a table, and asked her, what do you mean? Larissa, still shaken, crying, said she got into an argument with her boyfriend, and while inside the hotel room, he punched her once in the face with enough force for her to fall to the ground, and while on the ground, he stomped on her thigh. First of all,
Mr. Tsushima, in the Hammond case, the U.S. Supreme Court sort of drew a distinction between testimonial and non-testimonial evidence and indicated in its opinion that when the question is what happened versus what is happening, that what happened is testimonial evidence. And unless there was cross-examination on that prior statement, that would not be admissible in evidence. Mm-hmm. So, is there a problem here with the confrontation clause?
I'm sorry, I wasn't familiar with the facts of Hammond. But as far as the
Hammond was part of Davis, the Davis case.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The U.S. Supreme Court decided.
Sorry, I hadn't reviewed it in preparation for the oral argument. However, as to the confrontation clause, I believe Fields is dispositive as to the witness taking the stand and being available for cross-examination, that was sufficient for confrontation clause purposes. Now, in considering the factors and more.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Where the witness claimed total loss of memory, apparently, mm-hmm. of the incident. So the cross-examination didn't really go to the substantive matters of the statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
So do you need to have a meaningful cross-examination of the statement in order not to violate the confrontation clause?
Yes, I believe a meaningful cross-examination of the statement involves the with being able to ask the witness that very question, whether the witness remembers anything about the event. The fact that the witness is testifying as to a lack of memory is actually the result that is at many times the ultimate goal of cross-examination, to discredit the witness because of a lack of memory. So the witness testifying as to a complete lack of memory actually is the party's opportunity to cross-examination.
Can you run us through that, counsel, by cross-examining her and getting her to admit that she doesn't remember anything? How does that further the defense's efforts in this case?
I think it furthers the defense's efforts because it totally discredits her as to her credibility, as to the entire event. It attacks her memory and essentially anything that she can testify to.
But wouldn't it support the counter inference that she's now lying at trial and, in fact, what she said after the event was, in fact, the truth? And in that way, it actually tends to bolster the state's case.
Or that she's just – sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Only that she or that she's just not credible at all, actually, that she's not to be believed. And therefore, there's nothing to be believed. That is the argument that the party is able to make.
If she's not to be believed, how does that help your case?
How does that help our case?
Yes.
Well, it is difficult for us to have to counter that her credibility is being attacked for that reason. That is an uphill battle for us whenever the witness does take the stand and claims lack of memory. In the DV cases, it's a common hurdle that we have to go over.
What was the cause of her loss of memory? What she claims to be the cause?
What she claims to be the cause, or what she stated, was that what she last remembered was drinking a lot. In fact, I think the way she worded it was simply, I drink a lot. This has happened before, this happens. So she did testify that she had drank. I believe it started in the hotel room. It then moved to the bar. And I believe a fair inference would be that it was because she drank a lot that she was actually cut off. But I believe that she was stating it was due to the amount of drinking that she had lost her memory.
Wasn't it, in fact, the state's theory that she was lying at trial? Or, indeed, how did the state present the case? That, in fact, that she, her testimony that she was drinking and unable to remember was, in fact, truthful testimony? Or did the state suggest that, in fact, that showed that she was testifying falsely in order to protect her still boyfriend?
I believe that is the latter, that she was still in love with her boyfriend, that she didn't want to see anything bad happen to him, and that essentially, yeah, she's feigning lack of memory.
So the only evidence to support the conviction would be the police officer's testimony.
Correct.
And as to the police officer's testimony, are you claiming that all of what the police officer testified to as to what the complainant said constituted an excited utterance?
Yes.
All of it.
As to her statements, I was about to get to that certainly the first statement was an excited utterance, as that was given immediately upon the officer's arrival. Admittedly, he then sat her down, spoke with her, had a 30-minute conversation. To the extent that stress dissipates over time, admittedly, those statements would have to be looked at in a different manner, because those you'd have to look at were provided over a 30-minute period of time. It's our position that because these statements were brief, were short, exclamatory statements, that's also indicative that she was still under the stress of excitement. This wasn't a long, detailed speech, which you would expect from a 30-minute interview, it's essentially three statements.
Okay, Mr. Tsushima, basically, we're talking about two statements?
Correct.
Two statements, okay. When the officer gets in, he says, he asks, what happened?
Correct.
My boyfriend beat me up. That's a statement? That's the one statement?
That's the first one.
Okay. Then the second statement takes place at a table. He said he walks her in further into the room, sits her at a table because
yes.
she seems to be injured.
Yes.
Between the first statement and the second statement, how much time elapsed?
From what we have from the record, the complete time that the officer was in contact with Larissa was 45 minutes. When he testified as to the oral statement that was taken, I believe he made reference to 30 minutes. The first statement was uttered by Larissa when he immediately entered the room. So I guess a fair inference would be the second series of utterances were over a 30-minute period of time immediately after. There isn't a testimony from the officer that there is some kind of intervening action by him or any other officers. The testimony appears to be he walked her over to the table and then sat her down because he had seen her limping and in pain.
Yeah, see, again, my question goes to the elapsed time between the first statement and then speaking at the table. You're not saying it took half an hour, the time between.
Oh, no. It's unclear as to the timing of when the second series of utterances were given by Larissa.
Okay, it was 30 minutes that you referred to, is it the 30-minute are you referring to the conversation at the table?
Correct.
That took 30 minutes?
Correct.
Well, she gave a written statement as well.
Correct.
The 30 minutes is also part of the written statement?
No. My reading of the record, it appears that was given after the oral statement. I believe the officer testified that he had received her verbal utterances first, and then, although the 252 did not come into evidence, then she did write a 252. Given the general time frame that was provided, I believe the last 15 minutes is when we can infer the Larissa had written the 252.
Okay, I'm not real sure what took place. I mean, what was the information that took place that he received, the officer received from her statements in those 30 minutes?
Okay, it was just those three statements that she had gotten into an argument with her boyfriend, punched to the face, fell to the ground, and while lying on the ground, stomped on the leg. That was it.
Yeah, so it's hard for me to believe that took 30 minutes.
Yeah. Our whole position is that based on his testimony, he was saying he tried to calm her down during the entire 45 minutes and that her emotional state didn't change. The picture that provides to us is that she's crying the entire time. She's not able to give a continuous speech to the officer. His attempts to try to calm her down draws the picture of him saying words to the effect of, try to calm down and just getting nothing from her. That he's trying to ask her, what do you mean? Getting nothing from her. All we got from, and all he testified to was the three statements that about getting into an argument, punched and kicked and stomped on, that's it. So what that provides is a person who's so under the stress of excitement from the startling event that she can't even speak. She can't even get anything else from her. These are the only statements.
Evidence of injury?
Yes, there were visible injuries that the officer observed. He first observed a red mark on the lower chin area that he said was starting to swell as he was speaking with her. The second injury was a 2-inch by 2-inch red circular mark. I believe it was on her right thigh. And I guess that injury caused what he observed as a third injury, which was Larissa limping, apparently due to pain from her leg.
Okay, as far as the written statement, the prosecution is not claiming that the written statement should have gone in as well?
No.
Do you agree with the dissent filed by Judge Fujisi?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
So you agree this case should be remanded for a new trial?
Sorry, at least as to the first statement, yes. We believe all the statements should be coming in.
So are you abandoning your position that all of the statement was an excited utterance?
No.
No.
So,
but how do you agree with Judge
I should correct, because I agree with her that at the very least the first statement should come in and be remanded for trial. But we do believe all the statements were still made while she was under the stress of the Starling event. So to that extent, though, I do disagree with Justice Fujise. And when we're looking at the statement provided in Machado, the statement was an extended, lengthy narrative of not just the Starling event, but all the events leading up to it, including her relationship with her boyfriend. In fact, with the court's indulgence, I'd like to read the statement. I'll try to read it as quickly as I can. So what did the CW tell you? She said to me that she and Petitioner had been in a relationship for approximately a year and a half, and they have lived together at the residence for 4 months. Okay, on this evening, on the 27th, September 27, 2001, at approximately 6 p.m., she was with some friends at the Asian Sports Bar in Kahului and was waiting for Petitioner. She contacted him via telephone and found that he was somewhere else on Lower Main and that he'll be joining her, I believe, was stated in my report. She waited for another 2 hours. He still doesn't show up, so she left the bar at about 8 p.m. Upon arriving home, she cooked dinner, and then she began packing his belongings and threw it outside the residence, approximately 10 p.m. Approximately 10 p.m., he arrived home, and she had locked him out of the residence. He then attempted to gain entry by removing the screen on the kitchen window. Seeing this, she allowed him to enter the residence. Once within the kitchen area, Petitioner grabbed her from behind, holding her in what she said was a chokehold with his right arm. There was a struggle. He held her with her, okay? After he got her in a chokehold, her words were that, don't fuck with me. There was a struggle. He grabbed her hand with his left hand and pulled on her hair and wrestled her to the ground. While they were struggling to the ground, she had bit him on the left arm, on his left arm. And they were on the ground. She somehow got up out of his hold. He then stepped on her head. He reached for a steak knife with the dish rack there on the counter. After obtaining the steak knife, he stated that, don't fuck with me, I'll kill you. He then replaced the knife in the dish rack. She then kicked him in the groin area, at which time he released her. She stood up, attempting to leave the kitchen area. He grabbed her from behind, spun her around, and grabbed her by the throat. There was a slight struggle. She got up, she got loose from that, and contacted the police. That was the statement provided by the officer in Machado. And that was the utterance that the state was trying to get in that case. The ICA did not recognize that as a fact. That was distinguishable from our case. Our case had, I don't want to beat a dead horse, but our case just had the first statement that was initially stated at the door, and three utterances given over a 30-minute period of time.
Counsel, just to be clear, it is your position that those statements were given over the course of half an hour as opposed to immediately upon the officer sitting her down at the table?
In our case?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so somehow during the course of the half hour, so are those statements a summary of a longer discussion? Were they elicited at various points during that half hour? Was the officer calming her down for 25 minutes and then eliciting the statement? What happened? What does the record show?
The record does not show at what point the statements were given, whether it was in response to various questions from the officer. What we do know and what we have from the testimony is that he asked her what happened and that he calmed her down. We don't know at what points those statements were made, whether they were made after speaking with her over a 30-minute period of time. What we do have is that that's all he was able to gather from her in speaking with her over 30 minutes, and that he was unable to calm her down during this period.
Who has the burden of establishing that the statements are admissible? The proponent of the statements?
We do, yes.
Okay, so to the extent that there's ambiguity in the record about how long this whole incident lasted and when the statements actually came out, and to the extent that might be relevant to the analysis, that would be ambiguity that it was the state's obligation to address.
Yes, that would be on us.
Okay, and one other question, does the record show how long after the initial incident, the actual, whatever it is that happened between the defendant and the complaining witness, how long it was between that actual incident and the officer's arrival on the scene?
The record seems to indicate it was within minutes. It was during the 104 hearing, during cross-examination, that the defense counsel asked him, isn't it true the allegation, this allegation occurred at 1 a.m., and Officer Google confirmed yes.
Sorry, the call came in at 1 a.m. or the hitting occurred at 1 a.m.?
The
alleged hitting occurred at 1 a.m.
The incident at 1 a.m. That the incident, that the abuse had occurred at 1 a.m.
Based on what?
There's no further questioning as to where he got that information. The defense counsel just asked him, isn't it true that the allegation or the alleged incident occurred at 1 a.m., and he confirmed it.
Okay.
He didn't further delve into it.
Mrs. Tsushima, I understand that in your petition for your application for writ, you didn't bring up the confrontation clause. But inasmuch as it has been raised during oral argument today, mm-hmm. can you compare the cross-examination of the complaining witness in Fields with the cross-examination of the complaining witness in the present case?
To the degree that it dealt with the same underlying facts as to the declarant's, or I should say the witness's explanation as to her lack of memory as to the situation, it is substantially similar. She had testified that in that case as well that she had been drinking a lot, that the inference was that alcohol had affected her memory on the, as to the events that occurred during the startling event, the abuse. I believe Justice Moon had pointed out a distinction for, I believe in that case there was some form of a response as to, I want to say a surfboard or something that they were arguing about. In this case, we admittedly don't even have the witness testifying as to what the source of the argument was, at least at trial. We don't have anything of what was the source of how this incident had started, except for the excited utterance that explains that they were in an argument generically. But other than that, substantially similar as far as confrontation clause purposes are concerned.
They were an argument about dinner, did you say?
No, it was a generic argument. I don't think they specified as to what it was concerning.
In the present case. She said they were having an argument.
They were just having an argument. It wasn't specific.
Can you cite to any case where, like in this case, the witness just had no memory whatsoever? Like you said, in the Fields case, mm-hmm. there was cross-examination on the facts that led up to the argument, sitting on the surfboard trying to break it or something
right.
like that. Do you have any other case like this where she just had no memory whatsoever of that evening except for drinking at the bar and at the hotel?
I'm not sure Justice Nakayama will know more than I do, but I thought Fields had made reference to federal case. I had not prepared the confrontation clause issue fully to the extent of discussing Fields. So I apologize. I can't name a case off top. That would be a distinguishable fact from Fields. I would admit that. And I believe my time is up. Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Kersha Durant on behalf of Respondent Appellant Kenneth De Los Santos. Your Honors, this is not a case about excited utterances made to police officers. Rather, this is a case about statements made by an excited individual to officers. And statements of a merely excited individual do not qualify or fall within any exception to the hearsay rules. In this case, the ICA correctly reversed Mr. De Los Santos' conviction for abuse of family and household members in violation of HRS 709-906. The ICA did not gravely err in holding that Mr. De Los Santos' rights to due process and fair trial were violated when the trial court improperly admitted hearsay evidence as excited utterances. The ICA also did not gravely err in finding that absent that improperly admitted evidence, there was insufficient evidence to convict Mr. De Los Santos. And that is because that was the sole evidence in this case. The sole evidence to support the conviction were the improper statements, hearsay statements admitted by the officer. First, Your Honor, I would like to address the state's points that were raised, that this case is distinguishable from Machado. This case...
Excuse me, can I ask you what your position is on whether the declarant was under the stress of excitement at the time, and on what do you base your position?
With respect to the excited utterance, Your
yes.
Honor. In this case, that is one factor the court would have to consider. She was not suffering from the stress or excitement of an incident. It is clear from the record that it is actually unclear when an incident happened. I know there was reference about cross-examination of the officer during the 104 hearing by defense counsel asking that an incident happened at 1 a.m. But it is the officer has no personal knowledge of when an incident occurred. There is nothing to indicate in the record that an incident occurred any time before a call was made to the police officer. That was argued by our defense counsel at trial, and it's still unclear in the record that's presented to this court. So to assume that just because a call was made somewhere around 1 a.m., that an incident immediately preceded that is improper, and it's not indicated in the evidence.
So even though your own colleague questioned the officer, isn't it true that it occurred at 1 a.m., you're now saying that your own colleague was incorrect, or
I'm sorry, Your Honor,
and didn't know what we can't consider that.
Well, our position with regard to that question is that the officer would have not had no personal knowledge to respond to any counsel's question of when an incident occurred, because the officer was not there. That was elicited during the trial. The officer was not there, didn't know what happened. In trial, it's a common method to direct a witness in order that testimony be limited to focus on certain areas. And that form of question posed by our counsel was to do that, to direct him to the incident that we were talking about. But again, it's improper to infer that just because the officer's response was yes, that he somehow had some personal knowledge which he was unable to have. And furthermore, the officer never obtained any information from the complaining witness to indicate that there was an incident around 1 a.m., so it wouldn't have even been information made available to him through any type of investigation.
Doesn't the counsel, as an officer of the court, have a duty to not ask, shouldn't be asking a question that he or she knows to not be true?
Your Honor, I cannot represent, I was not the trial counsel, but
so
I think...
So we have to assume that the trial counsel was acting in good faith, don't we?
I believe he was acting in good faith.
Okay.
I don't think that the argument that I'm making would suggest that it was improper.
You just said it was trial strategy.
Not that it was trial strategy, Your Honor, but that he has to at least direct the witness to the question or to the area of subject matter that he wants to question on. He asked the officer, and again, the officer had no personal knowledge, whether there was an incident that happened about 1 a.m. This was the following questions after that were to discuss with the officer when he responded, when he received the call, when he got to the scene. It was to draw out the timeline. Whether or not there was an incident that happened at 1 a.m., is not clear from the record. And that question alone doesn't establish that an incident happened at 1 a.m. And I think that a counsel can ask a question in good faith on behalf of his client in order to guide the witness to the subject area, and that's what this counsel was doing. This case is, with respect to Machado and the state's argument that this case is, I guess, distinguishable from Machado. Machado, arguably, it did have lengthy statements, and the statements that were made available to the trial court in this case are shorter than that. But that was not the dispositive issue in Machado. The key holding of Machado is that the declarant doesn't have an opportunity for reflective thought. And in this case, there wasn't an opportunity for reflective thought. Again, it's not clear from the record when the actual incident occurred, but it is clear that there was a call from the police, or a call to the police, and that the officer was dispatched. And he was actually dispatched around 105 or 107. He did not arrive on scene until 110, and that is clear from the record. So there's already a delay, assuming that anything happened immediately prior to a police call, which is, again, not established in the record. When he arrives at 110, he doesn't immediately encounter the complaining witness. He enters the lobby of the hotel, where he meets with security guards. The security guards have to assist him by giving him a key to go up the elevator. There's an additional delay there. And while that no time limits were given in the record, it is clear that that happened, and that happened after he arrived on scene at 110. Once the officer went up to the elevator, and this was a unit that was higher up, it was in the higher levels of the hotel, so it took some time to get up to the room. Once he got to the room, there also wasn't an immediate entrance into the room. There were two separate doors. And he did explain that he had to figure out which door to go through, went through the door. Then when he went through the door, it was only at that point that he was able to encounter any of the parties involved with this incident. And even then, somehow before he confronted the complainant about what happened or asked her about what happened, he had an opportunity to observe her limping, observe her demeanor, and all of that happened prior to him even asking her what happened. So there was a delay in the incident, even on the record that was presented. And because of that, there was enough time for her to have reflective thought, for her to not be suffering from the stress or excitement of this incident.
Counsel, wouldn't the observations of her demeanor that the officer made support the inference that she was, in fact, still under the stress of that event? I mean, her immediate description, he says, when you arrived at the room, did you meet with anybody? Yes, the complainant, Mr. De Los Santos, and another waiting security officer. And did you make any observations? Upon arrival in the room, I immediately noticed she was really shaken, crying, and appeared to be in a lot of pain. She was limping. I observed her limping. Then he asked her the question, what happened? And her response to that question was, my boyfriend beat me up. Don't the circumstances of his observation of her demeanor, as well as her answer, and I believe that her answer can be used in determining the admissibility of the statement, her answer that what had caused him to be called there that night was her boyfriend beating him up. Don't those all support the inference that, in fact, she was still under the stress of the event, and the event was her boyfriend beating her up?
No, and this is why, Your Honor. First, it's allowable for an individual to be excited when they give a statement. And I think in this instance, she was excited. But the state, as the proponent of the evidence, has the burden to show that that excitement is not just excitement due to any extraneous reason, that excitement was resulting from this incident. And while I believe there could have been arguments fashioned so that that inference could have been made to the court, that was not clear from this record because of the length of delay. And additionally, that's only one of the factors that the court has to consider. And I think the nature and circumstances of this case, which was considered by the court in Machado, that analysis of the nature and circumstances, when applied to this case, the nature and circumstances of how the statement from the complainant was elicited is also significant. While at this point I'm not going to address the constitutional issues, it is significant that this question was not volunteered. It wasn't as if the officer walked into the room and the complainant immediately said, he beat me up. This question was posed by the officer after the officer had assessed the situation, and he even said he asked the question because he wanted to determine what had happened, make sure for his own safety. So this is already after the officer had viewed everything that had happened, had observed her limping, had observed her demeanor. Then the officer asked her what happened, and in response to that question, she offered the statement that the state is seeking to introduce. It wasn't volunteered, and that's counterintuitive to what an utterance is. An utterance, by the case law in this state, is something that is spontaneous. This is distinguishable from case law such as Moore, where a complainant is offering these statements because they're brief, disjointed statements, and they're unsolicited. In this,
counsel, is it your position that there can never be an excited utterance in response to a question from a police officer? Never.
I think to say that, given the other case law outside of this jurisdiction, that would require me to speculate, and I'm sure that there is a situation where that could happen. There could be simultaneous arrival of the police officer and a statement by the complainant at that time, but that's not what happened here. And I think for these particular facts, that the fact that it was elicited by the officer in response to a question, that nature and circumstance renders this statement not an excited utterance. And this court...
Was the defendant outside of the apartment when the police approached? Was he standing at the entrance?
The record seems to suggest he was standing outside. And this is another factor that the court has.
Was there another police officer that accompanied this officer?
Yes, Officer Kimura.
So there were two officers, and the security guard was there also.
Yes, Your Honor.
So they were all there before he encountered the complaining witness, before the officer encountered the complaining witness.
That's correct. And that is actually, those are actually intervening circumstances, we would argue to this court, that at the time of arrival, hotel security had already been on scene. There was already a security officer from the hotel in the room. There was no ongoing emergency or situation. The officers did encounter the defendant outside the room before they entered. There was another officer present. Even just the mere arrival of a police officer can arguably be an intervening circumstance that would prompt someone to immediately have reflective thought and come up with a story. But aside from that, there were other intervening circumstances, which is another factor that this court has to consider under excited utterance, under the analysis for whether or not this qualifies as an excited utterance.
And how do you respond, to Judge Fujisi's dissent, which indicated that, well, part of it was excited utterance, part of it was not?
Well, all the factors that I had that have been laid out and presented to the court would apply to the first statement and the second statement because all of those things happened before. I think it's clear, and I certainly agree with Judge Fujise, that the second statement, given the length of the statement, given the fact that that was not her actual, there's nothing in the record to indicate that that was her actual statements for the second portion. And by second portion, I'm referring to the statements that were made in the separate room at the table. And even the officer during the 104 hearing, when he was asked what she said, he said after speaking with her and getting the full facts and circumstances, this is what she basically said. He gave a summary, and I know there were questions about that with the state. Those were not, there's nothing to suggest those were her actual statements. This was the officer's summary of what happened. And it is clear from the record that he spoke to her for at least 30 minutes. And while some of that time he attributed to trying to calm her down, the statements that were offered were clearly a summary of a longer discussion that occurred over 30 minutes. It's just not feasible that that would have been the only thing that would have come out. And it's clear from the officer's testimony that this was basically what she said.
I don't want to take you away from your primary argument, but just sort of as an aside, was the statement, he beat me up, was that non-testimonial under Crawford and Davis, et cetera?
No, I think it's clear that this is a testimonial statement. This statement, sorry, 1 second, Your Honor. Just with respect to Judge Fujise's holding, I don't think that even if there was, the court were to consider and look closer at the first statement, the analysis would not stop there. The court would have to look at the constitutional requirements of Crawford. And in this case, this was a testimonial statement because the circumstances, some of them I've already discussed, do indicate that, again, there was no ongoing emergency in this case. The whatever had occurred, if anything had occurred, had subsided. Hotel security was on scene already. Defendant was separated from the complaining witness, not even near her. This is distinguishable from cases where an individual is calling on the 911 and reporting simultaneously what happened. That isn't what happened here. There was no ongoing emergency. And when the officer met with her, he made it clear that he had already assessed the situation, and his primary goal was to determine what happened. In fact, his question that he posed to her was what happened. And that falls squarely within the standard under Davis versus Washington that
if it's testimonial, then the statement, he beat me up, would have to be excluded under Crawford and Davis?
Well, that it was testimonial, and in this case, the complainant was unavailable, and that also the individual wasn't subject to meaningful cross-examination. We were not given the opportunity. So for those reasons, yes, it should be excluded. Even if the court were to consider it an excited utterance, it does not meet past constitutional muster under this.
Does prior cross-examination relate to the time at which the statement was obtained by the police?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could I ask you to rephrase
the requirement in Crawford that the statement be subject to prior cross-examination, does that pertain to the point in time when the police take the statement?
And I just wanted to clarify, the statement that is being offered into evidence, that's what the court is referring to.
Yes, he beat me up.
That statement, I think what is clear from the constitutional analysis is that for a statement to be entered, and I would argue, yes, they should be, defense counsel needs to be able to cross-examine about any statements that would be introduced in order to overcome Crawford, the constitutional standard. But I think, and this is what's also unclear from the record, there was initially attempts to introduce statements one way and then it kind of changed. So I think in this case, the fact that there was no opportunity to cross-examine the complainant at the scene and definitely no opportunity for meaningful cross-examination during the 104 hearing, during the trial, there was no opportunity for the defense counsel to formulate a defense on behalf of their client or to test the truthfulness of the complainant's statement. And the main crucible, the crux of confrontation is the ability to cross-examine. And I don't think it's sufficient to say that a defense counsel can argue, well, memory loss, and that's why she can't be believed because she lost her she doesn't remember what happened. That's not sufficient. That's not what our Constitution, the Hawaii Constitution, guarantees. It guarantees an opportunity to test the truthfulness of what happened. And if an individual doesn't remember what happened, there's no opportunity to cross-examine on the subject matter of the statement. And that was critical in this case, especially given the fact that this was the sole evidence used or offered to convict Mr. De Los Santos. And without the defense attorney being able to cross-examine about the circumstances of the minimal statements offered, if he beat me up and how it was done, he was essentially, any arguments he was needed to make were rendered futile, because he couldn't cross-examine the complaining witness. And I think from the constitutional scrutiny, that's a critical element that is missing in this case. I don't think it's disputed that she was unavailable. I mean, she had no memory. This is distinguishable from Fields, where in Fields, the individual had selective memory, memory about certain parts of the incident and not others. In this case, the complainant had no memory. When asked during the 104 hearing about what happened, she remembered nothing. When asked at the trial about whether she spoke with the officer, she didn't remember. Whether she made a written statement, she didn't remember. Even when confronted with the statement, she couldn't remember or attest to the subject matter contained within the statement. And then she followed up by saying she doesn't remember anything about what happened.
Counsel, did your office file a response to the application for writ of certiorari?
We did not, Your Honor.
And the confrontation clause, therefore, was not raised in response to the application from the prosecution. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, but I don't believe we've waived that because of the fact that we prevailed in the ICA opinion. And there was no need for us at that point to raise it. And also, the ICA didn't address it in the constitutional area or the issues in that case because of their decision. I think it was briefly referenced by Judge Fujise. But it is certainly something that, as an officer of the court, I feel I'm obligated to bring up if this court is going to consider the first statement.
But you didn't file a response, is that correct?
Our office did not file a response. But these arguments, the constitutional arguments, were all raised in the opening brief, in the answering brief. So these are not issues that were necessarily foreign or outside of what was considered.
Counsel, Mr. Tsushima indicates that when a witness takes a stand, like in this case, and the witness cannot recall what happened and so can't be cross-examined on the facts, I mean, she's saying she has no memory, but Mr. Tsushima indicates that as long as there's an opportunity to test the veracity of the witness, and you can attack the theory, raise a theory by inference that she's probably lying, that's all you need is the opportunity to cross-examine and test the veracity of the witness, truth and veracity of the witness.
And we would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think mere physical presence of a witness.
What authority do you cite for that?
1 second, Your Honor.
Yeah, we've got Fields that says that.
Yes, I mean.
So you say we should overrule Fields and indicate that that proposition that Mr. Tsushima sets forth is totally improper.
I think this case is distinguishable from Fields again, because in Fields, there wasn't a complete loss of memory. In Fields, there was selective memory by the complainant. So this is different. And I think even in Fields, even though it is discussed about availability of the witness, that there is still the long-held principle that means meaningful cross-examination. And in Fields, meaningful cross-examination occurred, or the court found that it occurred, because she was able to remember certain things. In this case, there was no meaningful cross-examination because she couldn't remember anything. It's not that she remembered portions. She remembered nothing. And that is a very distinct difference between the facts of this case and the facts of Fields. So I don't think that the court, in ruling in our favor in this case, would mean it has to undercut the principles of Fields. I think even under Fields' principles, that this making a holding in favor of the defense would still be consistent with the court's holdings in Fields. It's just applying to the facts of this case, it's very different.
How about federal cases or other cases from other jurisdictions? Has anyone gone addressed the exact situation we have here where a witness says that she was unable to recall because of intoxication or some other reason? Has anybody gone that far?
In between myself and counsel.
No, in any other jurisdiction, can you cite us other cases?
Your Honor, at this point, I'm not prepared to cite two state cases outside of this jurisdiction. But I think it's clear, even from our case law here, that even under the case law and the progeny, that in this case, the loss of memory did render this individual unavailable for cross-examination, meaningful cross-examination. She was present, but it was not meaningful. And, I mean, this issue has been raised in other cases. And I think what is also significant is that in a lot of these other cases, it's different because they're talking about prior inconsistent statements, whereas in this case, we're talking about admission of statements as excited utterances. And that's very different because just the nature of having a prior inconsistent statement suggests that there's a statement that is inconsistent with another. In this case, there wasn't even an initial statement to be inconsistent. That's why they attempted to introduce her written statement that way, and that was not successful. But this court, I'm sorry, I believe the ICA has also considered the loss of memory as unavailable with regards to the unavailability of
the SUA case that this court decided.
Yes.
SUA, didn't this thing was written by Justice Levinson, say that a witness who cannot remember is considered unavailable under the, at least our view of the Confrontation Clause?
Yes.
So not even, you don't have to even go outside of this jurisdiction.
Yes. And that is correct, and she was unavailable in this case, this particular complainant. And this is a very unique situation. While I know there was reference that this type of thing happens in domestic cases, Your Honor, in my experience, a witness in a domestic violence case coming in and remembering nothing, that is a very unique circumstance. What is more usual, the more common case, is something similar to Fields, where the witness remembers something or a little bit and not other things, selective memory in that sense. But this is a very unique case. And I think in this particular case, given the record, given her statements, she was entirely unavailable. Your Honors, because the complainant's statements in this case were not excited utterances, do not rise to the level set forth in the standards for admission as an excited utterance, it was improper for the trial court to admit those statements, and the ICA did not gravely err in finding that those statements were not excited utterances. And again, without those statements, without Officer Kubel's statements about what the complaining witness told him, there would have been no evidence provided to convict the defendant. And in this case, Your Honor, in the event that the court looks closer at the first statement, we are urging the court to consider subjecting that to constitutional scrutiny, that it's required. And under that, even the initial statement should not have come into evidence, and therefore there would have been insufficient evidence to convict. Mr. De Los Santos, we ask that the court affirm the ICA's decision.
The thrust of the state's argument is that the ICA gravely erred in its analysis and conclusion that Machado and the holding was not distinguishable from the facts in this case. The nature of Larissa's utterances were brief and exclamatory utterances, excuse me, directly related to the subject event and thus are clearly distinguishable from the statements provided in Machado.
Mr. Tsushima, looking at the answering brief that you filed on page 17 and 18, at the bottom of the page, you quote from Crawford, and I'll read it real quickly. Reiterate that when the declarant appears for cross-examination at trial, the Confrontation Clause places no constraints at all on the use of his prior testimonial statements. The clause does not bar admission of a statement so long as the declarant is present at trial to defend or explain it. Now, in the complaining witness's testimony, At one point, did she defend or explain the statements attributed to her by the police officer?
To the extent that she explained that I drink sometimes, this is what happens, I'd submit that was her explanation.
What was her explanation? She drank sometime to explain her statement, he beat me up.
That I drink sometimes, I guess she's saying, I say stuff like that. She's saying, I drink sometimes, these things happen, and she was cut off by defense counsel. She wasn't allowed to say anything more. That was her opportunity to explain the situation. I think that was her statement of, that's why I said it. Whether the jury bought it or not, well, doesn't appear the jury did.
Did that go to her explanation for loss of memory?
It was in response to the defense counsel's question, so you don't remember what happened. And then she gave that as her explanation. The two main reasons why the ICA's reliance upon Machado is erroneous is for two reasons. One is because not only was that such a lengthy narrative given by the police officer, but it was also outside of the realm of what's allowed as an excited utterance in that it started discussing matters that were outside of what happened that evening. She discussed her relationship with the defendant, a rendition of 4 hours of series of events that led up to the incident, and was very specific and detailed, as opposed to these brief utterances that were directly related to the subject event. I don't want to go over all the facts again, but our position is that these statements were given under the stress of excitement. And of course, stress is a subjective matter. For us to be able to determine whether Larissa was under the stress, we have to look at all the facts that we have before us, her demeanor, the physical injuries that the officer was able to observe, and the content of what she was able to speak at that time. And at that time, she wasn't able to give much detail. She wasn't able to speak. She gave about 4 utterances during the 30-minute time. And I think that paints the picture for us of what she was under, the stress of the excitement. Lastly, the state would want to point out that Officer Kubel's arrival on the scene was within minutes of the incident. And while Larissa was still very shaken, crying, that's when he asked her, what happened? She uttered to him, my boyfriend beat me up. And that's it. That's all she said. She didn't give any more. She didn't give any detail. Nothing. State maintains that initial utterance, my boyfriend beat me up, was clearly admissible as an excited utterance. And therefore, this case, at the very least, should not have been reversed, but remanded for a new trial. The court doesn't have anything else. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I have permission to speak?
Yes.
If I may, inasmuch as this is our last scheduled oral argument with you as presiding judge, on behalf of the court, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for outstanding service as presiding Chief Justice over oral arguments. It's been an honor to have been able to serve with you. And I'd like to ask our junior-most member of the court, Mr. Justice Rechtenwald, to make a presentation to you.
Thank you for not kissing me. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
We'll take this matter under advisement.